Playlisters, imagine this. It's 7 a.m. The sun is peeking through those blinds as you desperately cling to those last minutes of sleep until your iPhone starts blowing up. Ping, ping, ping. Who could this be? Oh, it's Anna asking what today's episode is going to be about. And then Anthony's adding in useless humor that I don't need. So, Playlister, instead of texting you at the crack of dawn with the latest and greatest from the young Congress under the age of 45, I'm just going to ease you into a nice happy hour by saying,
welcome to Political Playlist.
All right. Are we ready, guys?
Happy hour.
Happy hour. You fucked that up so bad.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Political Playlist Happy Hour. Right. I'm Michael Kristoff.
I'm Anna Muskie-Goldwyn.
I'm Anthony Barquette.
Just to be fair, Michael, like, when you did the thing about the texts, you don't... Anthony and I text early. You pop in at, like, 10 a.m. with... like an essay of everything that we're saying that's wrong.
Because there has been 30 texts prior to that at 7 a.m.
We're early birds. We get the worm.
Just to be clear, Michael, we've already had lunch at 7 a.m.
I mean, my goodness. It's like more alerts. I always fear that something has happened to somebody.
But then as I'm trying to work, then you come in and like rattle off a million texts, completely negating everything that Anthony and I have said.
That is so fun to do at 10 a.m. Let me just say
it's more like 11:30.
I will agree with Michael though. I mean, not as late as Michael's, but if someone texts me early, I think something seriously is wrong.
Yeah. Do you guys wake up?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
See, I don't sleep with my phone in the room.
Yeah,
so
I sleep with my phone on.
You don't? That's insane. What happens if something does happen? And
well, something did happen last weekend in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And I woke up at 7:30 on Sunday to a flurry of texts.
Yeah.
From Billy saying he was in a life or death situation.
Oh, my goodness.
That's not funny. Sorry.
To be fair, he was not. It was a little bit overdramatic. I mean, it was a situation, but he was not on the brink of death. But he was like, this is why you have to sleep with your phone in the room, blah, 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 blah. I was like,
yes,
I'm not anticipating that you're going to get into life or death situations.
Gang, another week, another tidal wave of activity. I have a fun little news item here that has nothing to do with Congress, but I just think it's so cool and interesting.
Amazing.
So this week, Biden is hosting the Prime Minister of Japan at the White House, and they're having
I know what you're going to say.
D.C. is undergoing this like huge renovation around the Jefferson Memorial, and they're like having to redo like a seawall or whatever. So they have to uproot a bunch of these Japanese cherry trees, which have been gifted to the U.S. since 1912. Do you know any of this?
No,
yeah.
I did not know any of this.
Yeah.
Wow.
So as a gift from Japan, in honor of the U.S.'s upcoming 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, which will be in 2026, Japan is gifting the U.S. 250 Japanese cherry trees to replace the ones that they have to dig up for this renovation. Like, how freaking cool is that?
I love it. That's diplomacy at its best.
Amazing. That's diplomacy
awesome.
At its best. Also, like, I feel like, is there a more thoughtful culture than Japan?
No, honestly, no. I can't wait to go there. I've never been.
I know. Me too. It's like even more high on my list now.
And very like slow moving and intentional.
Yeah.
I feel like I would be brokering this deal. Like if I worked in the White House, and then I'd be like, you know, if you want to throw a couple cherry blossoms towards me too, that's fine.
Yeah.
You can make it a little bit more than 250.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's call it 265.
My yard could really use some sprucing up.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. I have a positive news item as well that is also completely unrelated to politics. And guys, I'm asking you genuinely, please refrain from the jokes.
Oh, God.
Please respond earnestly, knowing that what I'm about to say is something that is very meaningful and heartfelt to me.
I'm going to put myself on mute so I don't laugh.
And I'm exiting this episode, and it has to do with women's basketball.
It does.
Oh, my goodness.
Come on.
All right. Let's come hear on. It.
Okay. So the women's NCAA basketball championship game between South Carolina and Iowa, which South Carolina won, drew almost 19 million average viewers and peaked at 24 million viewers. This eclipsed the male final, which only had about 14 million average viewers. Now, not only did this shatter records to become the most watched women's college basketball game ever, but it actually was the most watched basketball game of men's and women's college and that WNBA and the NBA during the last 5 years. So I just wanted to put this out there because I'm like living in my nostalgia of being a female college athlete. And I think it is so freaking cool that these women are getting recognized. And I am very hopeful for the future of women's sports because of what these women in college, specifically in basketball, but otherwise are doing right now. So that's my moment. Don't laugh at me.
I will say awesome. I watched more women's basketball than men's basketball.
Yes.
This NCAA tournament.
Me too. Me too.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
See, I really did it.
That's the response I was looking for.
I really did it so I can, you know, get to know Anna a bit more. That was mm-hmm. it. You know,
just it's still a mystery, admittedly.
It's still a mystery. It wasn't helpful.
Yeah.
Anthony?
News? Yeah, so I'm going to bring us back to the political world.
Oh, great. Thank goodness.
I mean, this is also someone from our platform, Guy Reschenthaler from Pennsylvania, introduced a bill that would rename Washington Dulles International Airport to, I want this stated for the record, Michael and Anna's favorite president, Donald Trump International Airport.
So he was the guy who did it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Wait, did you then see that then like some Democrats were like, let's name a prison after him? Sorry.
Well, yeah. Two, I will say, like, he is a former president, right?
Yeah,
like, there's going to be some, you know, whether it's an airport.
Yeah, but an airport's like a bit like big.
Yeah.
Like I mean, airport feels like.
There's not many. I mean, but like, I guess it's the Reagan, which is not really used as much for commercial. And
yeah, but like I feel like JFK, you know, like it's like
right.
An airport's like a big one. Like he'll get like a street, you know, like Obama has like Obama Boulevard in LA.
Well, there was a funny SNL joke on Weekend Update where Colin Jost was like, they want to name an airport after Donald Trump, which is fitting because like Donald Trump, every time I go to this airport, it's a nightmare. It was pretty good.
So I just looked this up. There's, let's see, 8 airports named after presidents.
Huh. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we have JFK in New York, mm-hmm. George Bush in Houston, Ronald Reagan in D.C., Gerald Ford in Grand Rapids, Michigan, mm-hmm. Abraham Lincoln, Springfield, Illinois.
Okay.
Oh, there's a Bill and Hillary Clinton National Airport.
Where, in Arkansas?
Little Rock, Arkansas.
And we have, of course, famously John Wayne Airport in Orange County.
It's true.
Wait, but John Wayne was not a president.
He was not a president.
Oh, no? I think he's played one,
just,
though.
Are we just running through every
airport?
We're
just going through names. Yeah.
And then we have Eisenhower in
and then
Kansas,
we have LAX. And then we have...
and Roosevelt in North Dakota.
Oh, well,
I mean, JFK and Bush are really the big ones here.
This is the thing, though, is like the Washington airport, I feel like, anyway, I'm not for this for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
But let's get into some tweets because I've got a
big one.
I got a big one. I actually have two tweets. I'm going to read one of them first and then we can talk about the other one in our discussion. Okay. I just need to take a deep breath.
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Jesus.
All right. This should not be a felony, and Republicans need to be as vocal as they can be across the country rebuffing the Arizona ruling on abortion yesterday. It is up to Arizona to fix it now.
Nancy Mace.
Good job.
Boom.
So
I'm like the Caitlin Clark of guessing tweets. Okay. I just want to say.
Was that two tweets?
That was one. No, I have another one that I'll kind of bring up, but I thought that I wanted to start with this one. You know, if you have been on social media today, if you have watched the news today, this Supreme Court ruling, not National Supreme Court, the Arizona Supreme Court ruling on a new/very old abortion law came out. I'm just going to kind of set up what happened and then have, you know, we can talk about it because there's a lot of implications for this other than just like, are you pro-life? Are you pro-choice? Basically, what happened was that when Roe v. Wade was repealed, there was an 1864 law that had been essentially like kept dormant while Roe v. Wade was the law of the country. And this 1864 law made abortion illegal from moment of conception. So now, so then Arizona passed its own 15-week abortion ban, which obviously many pro-choice people saw as extreme in and of itself. That 15-week ban did have exceptions for life of the mother, rape, and incest, importantly. Now the Supreme Court is basically kind of nudging that 15-week ban away and going back to this 1864 law, which, by the way, was enacted before Arizona was even a state.
Yeah, so Arizona became a state in 1912.
So if you want to say, okay, actually this became law in 1912 because if it's not a state, it can't have a law, blah, 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 whatever your technicality is. But essentially, what this law says is that abortion now is illegal. 2 weeks from now, it will go into effect, is illegal in Arizona from the moment of conception. The only exception is the life of the mother. So there's no exception for rape, no exception for incest. And as has been sort of well documented, the life of the mother question is incredibly difficult for doctors to kind of practice around because when is it, you know, when can you deem that life of the mother is in danger? Is that something that they have to literally be on their deathbed? So there's a lot of kind of
right. And, you know, gray area in that. We should add that this law would criminalize the actual practice of giving abortions. So it would hold the doctors criminally liable.
Absolutely. Well. And it carries a sentence of 2 to 5 years in prison. So the law does suggest that doctors should be prosecuted under this. Interestingly, the opinion that was written by the court did not actually explicitly say that. That doesn't mean anything because the law is the law. The opinion is not the law.
Right.
But I thought that was an interesting thing. But, you know, what we can go into the intricacies of this law, although it is pretty simple. What is perhaps most pertinent to our moment in this law is what it means politically. So just to throw a couple things out there, Carrie Lake, who is the senator or the woman running for the Republican as a Republican for senator in Arizona, has come out and saying that this law went too far, which is like a big LOL. Carrie Lake is about as far right as you can get. I wanted to read my second tweet and then you guys can kind of take it away, which is from our boy, Ruben Gallego, who's running against her. And he posted like a pretty emotional video, actually, that we'll share on our Instagram. But his tweet was, today's ruling is devastating for Arizona women and their families. This is not what Arizonans want. This decision rips away the right for women to make their own healthcare decisions with their doctors. I promise you that we will fight this all together. And with your help, we will win. He also has tweeted basically saying, like, Carrie Lake is trying to fool you. Don't listen to her. This is a huge boost for him. How do you guys think that this is going to play out politically going forward into the 2024 election?
I think that Arizona just went blue. I will bet my life on it that Arizona has now become a blue state. Republicans literally have just handed it to the Democrats.
Interestingly, the quote I read from Nancy Mace was actually part of an interview she did on Newsmax.
Oh,
and I will tell
very
you
prestigious
that when Newsmax is even pushing back on how extreme a law is, you know that positions are trying to be reversed, right?
Yeah.
But something that Nancy Mace said, and you know, it's like I have such weird feelings about Nancy Mace because I feel like I do think she genuinely cares about this issue because she is a mother. She is a survivor of rape. And what she was saying, though, was that basically Arizona State House, which is majority Republican, needs to legislate on this immediately so as to take it off the table in November. That probably won't happen. I think that it's going to be on the ballot. And I agree with you, Michael. What do you think, Anthony?
I actually agree with Michael as well on this.
Let the record show.
We have a consensus.
I'm going to agree with Ruben as well. Like, I think Carrie Lake's like, wait, what? No, absolutely. But probably behind the scenes.
Yeah. She's like, great job, guys.
It's not even behind the scenes, though, Anthony. Like, she is on the record saying at some point that this law was a, quote, great law. It's not even behind the scenes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, but like her statement of saying this went a little too far.
Yeah.
And I was actually I met someone today and, you know, he just sort of like brought up the election and I was like, you know, what are your thoughts? And he's like, he's like, I vote Republican all the time. But he's like, what just happened in Arizona? He's like, I don't understand what the Republicans keep doing on this issue where you're like, especially in a place like Arizona, we both kind of joked. He's like, yeah, I mean, we've partied in Scottsdale and Phoenix before. Okay,
there's a lot of dudes making bad decisions.
A lot of sex down there. So
that is great.
Well, but also it's to that point, like I think there are a lot of parts of Arizona that are sort of more extreme and potentially very religious. But I think Arizona is a state where a lot of the conservative viewpoints come from like stances on immigration. I think also come from, you know, there's a lot of cities in Arizona. So I think there's a lot of maybe fiscal conservatives in Arizona that might, you know, be in and around those cities. So I totally agree with your friend.
Sorry, go ahead, Anthony.
I was just going to say, why now? Like, right. This is definitely, I think, if on the Democrat side, you better be pushing this.
Yeah. This is a
they
gift.
Are. Trust a me, gift. They are.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you brought up immigration, right? And I've said this before and now I'm even more confident in the statement, which is that immigration for a lot of people is an existential issue. Yes, of course, there are, you know, immediate implications and impacts felt and seen and lived for people in some of these border towns like El Paso and people in large cities like New York who have massive immigration issues going on in those cities. But for your average voter, this is an existential issue, okay? But women's reproductive freedom is a rights issue that affects half of the voters. And I have talked to Democrat and Republican women, and not a single one of these people that I have talked to has said, you know, I'm going to be okay having somebody tell me what to do with my reproductive rights so that I can fight the greater fight on immigration or the economy. It's like, I just don't know a single women voter like that, or if they even exist at all. And we are talking about moderate and independent and Republican women in suburbs. I just do not see how they could possibly not vote on this issue.
And that is exactly what Nancy Mace is trying to get across. I think she's quite a good messenger for that on the Republican side.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the actions are not matching her wishes. The last go ahead.
I just have a question about this because I'm thinking about, obviously, the facilities that offer this. Because you said it comes into play in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. They have time to, hear appeals from lower courts. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. I was going to say, man, that must suck for some of the families in there and then I need to, you know, move.
100%. I mean, it's what happened in Alabama. There were all these IVF clinics that suddenly had to shut their doors. You know, their employees were furloughed. The women who were like mid IVF had to stop. It's going to be the exact same thing. There are women who had abortions probably scheduled for 2 weeks from now in Arizona for completely legitimate reasons who now will have to go out of state. Yeah.
I thought the Biden campaign released a political ad this week that I don't know if you guys saw it, but I would encourage you to watch it. It is unbelievably powerful. And it's with a woman named Amanda Zarowski, who was a woman in Texas who had a miscarriage and she needed to get an abortion. But in Texas, medical abortions are fully prohibited, even in the life of when the life of the mother is at stake. And so they were not able to do this. She subsequently got infections and now it doesn't seem like she and her husband can have kids. And it is this incredibly emotional campaign ad. And again, I like with every single one of these I see this being such a bigger driving issue for voters. And I'll say that I had thought my prediction, if you asked me a month ago, was Biden is going to win the presidency. Democrats are going to take the House. Republicans are going to take the Senate by one seat. I honestly think that if these senators running in Republican states don't double down on this issue and find a way to do it, I think Democrats are going to take the Senate as well. I think it's going to be a full blue sweep based off of primarily this issue.
I just wanted to address something before we move on. Like, Anthony, you had said kind of like, why now? Or like, just interesting that it's all happening right now. And it just, it's made me think, and I sort of came up with this thought of like, I think, look, it's horrible that we're going through this moment. If, I mean, look, if you're listening to this and you're pro-choice and you think this is amazing, that is your right. You have every right to believe that. I think it's really hard to argue with the fact that there should not be exceptions for rape, incest, and life of the mother. But in any sense, it's horrible that we're going through this moment. And I think it's horrible that so many women are going to get hurt and maybe even die, or like this woman you alluded to in the ad, get infections that alter their life dramatically. But what is so interesting to me about this is the proof. This is the proof needed to show where Americans really are. So at some point, no one of any party is going to be able to hide behind the argument that most Americans want these bans or most Americans want these limitations, because votes and general cultural opinion are showing that that's not true. So, of course, I wish this wasn't happening. Of course, I wish that my rights as a woman were not being toyed with in a way that even like my mother never had to worry about for most of her adult life. But like progress is not a straight line, right? So progress in this case might look like these extreme decisions coming down and exposing what the general public opinion actually is. Because if you have networks like Newsmax and freaking Carrie Lake, one of the most extreme far-right Republicans that we've frankly ever seen run for Senate, if they're walking back extreme pro-life positions and extreme pro-life views, like, the proof is in the pudding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, 100%.
Who's next?
All right. I'll take us to the Middle East.
Yeah, go for it.
A little around the world.
Haven't talked about that.
Yeah.
Oh, that old thing. Once again, the families of hostages held in Gaza came to the Hill to keep pushing for their loved ones' release. My colleagues and I stood beside them. Enough is enough. Hamas must release the hostages now.
Oof, that could be a lot.
I mean, could be anybody.
Let me give you a hint. This is somebody from a crucial battleground state with the highest Arab American population.
Oh, John James.
Somebody we haven't talked about in a while. Good OG.
Good OG. Michigan? OG.
I mean,
man or woman?
A woman. No.
No, she's too old now. We don't talk
about she wouldn't be on that scene.
Guys, Haley Stevens.
Oh, my God. Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Haley. Haley, we love
the ultimate
Haley.
Michigan
Haley,
accent.
We love you. Great Michigan
Haley,
accent.
Love you.
Yeah. I should have done this. I should have read this tweet in a Michigan accent.
You should have.
But it's not a funny tweet, so that might
Our listeners would have loved that.
Yeah. Don't you know?
I'm pretty good at impressions. I don't know. That wasn't Michigan. That was like Minnesota.
Well, similar.
Michigan and Minnesota are not the same.
They say pop and beg.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they really do. It's very crazy. So I think that I picked this tweet because I know we've talked a lot about this issue on from a number of points of view. And I wanted to kind of add a couple thoughts to this, which is, first and foremost, I feel like what is getting lost in this conversation is the fact that there are still hostages being held. And some of them have been killed and died in captivity. Some of them are missing in captivity. There's over 130 hostages being held. And I feel like there has not been enough discussion about, like, we need to get these hostages free. And by the way, I think you could also make the argument that, you know, a lot of these innocent Palestinian people are being held hostage by their own government and their own, you know, leadership, which is Hamas. So my question for you guys is, it's a drinking game. It's like, okay, everybody take a sip. So my question for you guys is, why do you think that none of the pro-Palestine, pro-Gaza leaders and leadership and people who are really vocally leading that brigade have suggested what to do about Hamas?
What do you mean what to do?
So one of the things that I feel like has been really absent in all of this conversation, you know, you've got people who are pro-Israel, people who are pro-Gaza, but nobody on the pro-Gaza, pro-Palestinian side of things has suggested a strategy or a solve for what is a very real problem, in that Palestine is run by a terrorist organization mm-hmm. that perpetrated this terrorist attack during a ceasefire. You know, and I feel like this is, and coupled with the fact that there are still 130 some odd hostages still being held by Hamas, which is using its people as a shield. You know, why do you guys think that so much of the pro-Palestine movement has not been talking about this, or has not been suggesting a strategy on how to solve what seems to be a very big problem for them?
I mean, to be fair, I don't know that anyone is suggesting a strategy other than kill people until we kill all of Hamas. Like, I don't know that that's totally a fair question. And like, I, by the way, I agree with you, but I don't know that that's totally a fair question, because the only strategy so far that has been suggested is to attack parts of Gaza and try to kill the tens of thousands of members of Hamas who, to your point, are using their own citizens as human shields. So I don't know what the answer is. And I mean, it, yeah. In my mind, it has to go back to Iran, like it has to go back to Iran, right? Like I think there's a larger foreign policy conversation to be had about that. Mm. But I think that if I were AOC, if the only policy that is being perpetrated or suggested to get rid of Hamas is in the meantime killing tens of thousands of innocent people, most of them children, then like, I don't know. I mean, I'm just thinking like, what good is a counter to that if like you can't, I'm putting myself in her head, like if you can't, if you can't kind of prove that that is the wrong approach. I don't know. I mean, it's a really good question. Like maybe that is a better use of time, but it just feels like there's this immediate problem, which is.
Well, all right,
let me put it a different way. Geopolitical conversation, which is
right.
How to deal with terrorist organizations.
Let me put it a different way. Do you think that the pro-Gaza movement here would be more effective in getting a ceasefire right now, in curbing, you know, what is clearly a large number of innocent civilians being killed in the name of pursuit of Hamas, mm-hmm. if that side of the leadership, like AOC and others, were more vocal about the fact that, hey, we have to do something, the root of the issue is Hamas. Do you think that they would be getting more traction that way?
No, because I actually think that they are getting more traction than everyone else. Like, I think that, frankly, there is nothing that gains more traction than the horrific images and videos and reporting that comes out of Gaza and the humanitarian crisis. Like, geopolitical terrorist organization aside, that is... Right. The thing that has made Biden get more hardcore about it. It's the thing that has created, like, you know, we're still sending them weapons, but has created more tension between the U.S. and Netanyahu. Like,
well, what about the hostages? Do you think that would help the pro-Israel side to be messaging about the fact that there are still these hostages?
I think they're trying. I mean, honestly, I think it's Netanyahu. I think that, like, I was reading somewhere that the more that he... I don't want to be like a conspiracy theorist about it, but like the more that this is prolonged, the more he's able to hang on to power, because you can't have
because he has massive issues. Yeah, he has real
leadership in the midst of all this. And now there's been all these protests in Israel, right, basically saying you're not doing what you need to do to get the hostages back. And I think that that ultimately is going to help in America the quote unquote two sides of this issue, which, like, I hate to put it as that because I think it's so much more complicated than that binary. But, like, ultimately, that I think is what's going to help people understand the other side, is that it's not about, like, borders. It's about these people, whether they be Israeli hostages in Gaza or whether they be innocent Gazans who are dying, that are all caught in the crossfire of, right, essentially this, like, political conflict that, unfortunately, like we've seen in other countries, is rooted in large part in the ego of one man.
Okay, by the way,
Anthony, please come step on these hot coals.
Come on, Anthony, you got it.
By the way, I'm still here. I'm on this podcast.
Oh, hey, buddy. Yeah. Did you leave the room? Where'd you go?
Yeah, I did.
It's like we're at a bar and you just stepped out to go to the bathroom.
I think the tough part here is everyone's sort of pushing for this ceasefire. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, the U.S. can only do so much to push Israel and Hamas to do that, right? Like, once again, I feel like we're dealing, the U.S. is the parent here, and they're telling their kids to stop doing something. And I'm using that term lightly because, you know, in the scheme of things, the U.S. is still the giant in the world. And us even just saying we need this to stop, ceasefire, I just don't see it truly happening. I really just don't see it happening. Like, in the meantime, there's still going to be tons of killings that are going on, you know, and then if some bomb does happen, who's going to take credit for it, right? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think we've seen an issue like this happen in the Middle East over and over again. And at the end of the day, I think it's almost like the wrong thing to be fighting for right now.
Mm. Hmm. Here's an interesting little statistic. So do you know that the, like, handful of Hamas leaders who all live in 5-star hotels in Qatar are worth collectively $11 billion, reportedly?
Wow.
Yeah, the top three leaders, one of whom is, like, the military leader. Mm-hmm. They are, like, multi-billionaires. And that's just what's on paper reported. And I think it's, like, you know, again, of things that aren't really being talked about a lot, it just seems like so much of the issue is with Hamas.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's astounding to me that this group is sort of able to act as kind of impunitively as they do in a place like Qatar, who, by the way, has actually been a very important, you know, frenemy in a way to the United States. That, you know, I say frenemy because they're not, like, a super close ally, but they've actually been a very reliable partner.
They've been helping negotiate all of these deals.
Yeah. But they're kind of like I kind of imagine Qatar as, like, that bar in Star Wars, you know, where, like, all of the bad dudes hang out and they're just milling about and, like, all the shit goes down there. Mm-hmm. But, like, everyone's untouchable there. That's what I imagine Qatar to be. No offense. No offense to Qatar. Right. And hookah. Yeah. Anyway, it continues to be a very, frankly, an awful situation on every side of the.
Well, one last thing. I also read this afternoon that there's now evidence that there is an Iran strike being potentially planned on Israel, which will only escalate this. So,
yeah.
Moving on, Anthony, take us home.
Okay. So this is in response to Ukraine potentially.
Hey, Ukraine.
Ukraine. Hey, Ukraine, what up?
Ukraine potentially being a NATO member. So this is completely irresponsible. To invite them during a war is to invite our nation into war. Do you want American troops in Ukraine?
Mm. I agree with that sentiment.
What did you say?
I think it's a Republican.
It is a Republican. I'll give you that.
Is it J.D. Vance?
Mike Lawler.
It is J.D. Vance.
Oh, come on.
Senator Vance.
This is rigged.
So, and this was in response to Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. Great.
Anthony.
You should go start going by Anthony.
I do in Europe. But
Anthony.
This was in relation to him talking about Ukraine. And the reason why I wanted to bring it up is this is going to, I think, be a major issue, especially when if Trump becomes president again, is we know he is not a fan of NATO. Now, I wanted to just give people a bit of a history lesson.
Mm.
You know, NATO was started in 1949 by 12 countries.
Go on.
And the bit, so they now have 32 members across Europe and North America.
Wow.
In it. After the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, many of the Eastern European countries joined during that time. But here was interesting to me. So they have to commit to spending dollars. So remember how member states have to spend at least 2% of national income on defense to NATO. So who do you think are the highest spenders?
In NATO?
So in NATO. And remember, Donald Trump said that.
Right. Everyone has to pay their fair share.
Yeah. So he thought
the highest spenders.
He thought many of the countries weren't putting their fair share.
And just to sort of further clarify that, this is not like you're paying membership dues at Soho House. Like this is you have to commit this amount, 2% of your GDP towards the military budget of your country. So it's not, again, there's not like some NATO bank account where it's like, all right, we got Germany's check this month. Sweden's a little delinquent.
Is Germany one of them?
All right. So in 2023, less than the 2% was France, Germany, Italy, Spain.
Wow.
Now, who do you think? And in 2023, there was an unprecedented rise in defense spending by several of the NATO members.
Okay. Including?
That hit their 2% level. Now, who do you think is the highest out of all of them?
I'm going to say not the U.S. I'm going to say England.
U.K.?
Poland.
Poland! Oh,
well, that makes sense because the country next to them is at war.
Yeah. Right?
So I thought that like this was all kind of a little bit of fast. It makes sense,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
A little fast. U.S. is at 3.5%. But well, also, you'd be surprised at the other like top 10. It was like Lithuania.
Well, it's all the ones near Russia.
Yeah.
All the former Soviet countries. You know, I'm.
What was? Did France have a reason? They were like, not this year.
Yeah.
Well, because but like Germany historically, ever since World War II, is like very nervous about defense spending. So that's just like a cultural thing where they don't spend a lot of money on defense because
we don't have a good record.
Yeah, they did that. Things didn't go so well. I also feel like the French are just kind of like the French and the Spanish are like, we're hands off, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I could see President Trump saying he brought up everyone to the 2% margin jokingly. He should take credit for this since he did talk about it.
Yeah.
But here's my other thought.
Technically, Putin got them up to the 2%.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Technically, there's more going on. But I do think, you know, J.D. Vance's question here, do you want troops, you know, American troops in Ukraine? I feel the majority of people overwhelmingly, I'm going to put this, you know, over 85% are going to say, no, I don't want U.S. troops there. Right.
Yeah.
And that's always those questions are very tough for me because I really don't think people want American troops to have to be anywhere.
Yeah. Right. I mean,
I have to say, well, I was just going to put on my clock. I just want to, let me just get the words in here. Let me put on my Hillary Clinton hawkish hat here and say that I am not necessarily against sending troops to Ukraine. And I'll tell you why, because I think that we are at a pretty watershed moment in the world that we've never been in since World War II. And I think that it is incumbent on the United States to send a message to the world saying that this is unacceptable. And I think, and I think a lot of people could make strong cases against me here, but I think the hawkish point of view is that there is no stronger statement than the U.S. military. And if you were to send the U.S. military to Ukraine, that would tell the world that this is the red line. And I think that, you know, that is a red line that no dictator presently would be willing to cross, including Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think it's hard because I do think that what J.D. Vance is saying as a soundbite makes sense. I mean, you said like you kind of agree with it. I think that that also, the idea of America actually going to war, I think it's more than just, like, I agree with what you're saying about troops, but I think that troops mean we're in a war, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that the idea of being in a country at war, especially when we just went through what seemed like an endless war for so many people in the Middle East after September 11th, like, mm-hmm. I think that it's very hard to, it's a hard thing to palate. And I think that J.D. Vance is, for that sort of populist section of the Republican Party, I think he's a very good and eloquent messenger. And sort of reports are saying that that is creeping him up on the VP list, because I think he provides a counter to Trump in that way, that he's like very measured and very practical in the way that he speaks. But I it's hard because I agree with your theory, Michael, of like, yeah, you put American troops there and like,
yeah,
it helps. But at the same time, you put American troops there and then it's like, well, what's the end? Right. Like, we don't necessarily know. Right. We're not dealing with terrorists. We're dealing with like another nation state. So maybe so there is a difference. But
yeah.
But I think that voters generally are reactionary. We're not, most of us are not thinking about foreign policy on a daily basis. The idea of being, quote unquote, at war is scary.
Right. Yeah.
That's it.
Cheers to that.
Who has the last call before we go?
I don't know. That's a pretty good ending.
That is.
Okay.
No one wants to be in war.
My last call is no war. Peace, love, happiness.
Peace.
And watch women's basketball.
And watch women's basketball. Well, the WNBA. PSA. My last call, the WNBA draft is on April 15th.